Now, 1 Samuel ends with the death of King Saul, and 2 Samuel begins now with a recap of the death of King Saul, which is a very interesting thing, which I told you we would get into that when we got together here tonight. But one thing to remember is this book will now record much of David's reign. We will learn that as David refused over and over, he had many opportunities, literally, to rush the hand of God. David refused to take the kingdom by force. He had the opportunity to do that. Literally, you know, he was in the cave. He could have easily killed him right there. You remember the story where he went into the camp and they all were asleep. God caused a heavy sleep to fall upon them. David walks in right in the midst of them, takes Saul's spear, takes a jug of water. I mean, he had the opportunity. He could have killed him right then. But he refused to do something in the energy of the flesh. So David is a picture, a type of walking in the spirit. Saul, another picture of Saul, is the man of the flesh. David refused to take this by flesh. I wonder, personally, as we have seen, David knew that God was in control. He said, I will not force this issue. I will not take the kingdom by force. When God's done with Saul, he'll move him out. It's not my job to press this thing forward. It's not my job to begin the ministry in the energy of the flesh. You know, when God's ready, he'll put me there. It's a beautiful picture. But I wonder if David knew the whole story of Ishmael. And I wonder if maybe David looked at that and went, you know, I don't want an Ishmael in my life. You know, we'll never know other than the fact that David was a man of godly character. And so this is going to record all about David, you know, about his reign and how he begins so beautifully. How it starts is just this amazing picture of patience and graciousness. But then we're also going to see the mistake that he makes. And so David's been on the run for 10 years. 10 years he's been running. You know, 10 years. God has had him in training, preparing him to be the next king of Israel. Training him, revealing his heart, putting him in situations where his heart is going to literally be revealed. And over and over and over, David has passed the test, passed one test after the next. And Saul, on the other hand, kept failing them all the way up until he went to the witch of Endor, and we saw that whole thing. And so it's time for a new king. David has, you know, been patient. God has finished training David. Saul, he's been removed, and so it's time for a new king. And so that's kind of where this begins. Now, some people wonder, well, okay, well, wait a minute. It's called 2 Samuel. 1 Samuel, much of it was written by Samuel. So who wrote 2 Samuel? Well, that's an interesting mystery. Some people believe that it was Nathan's son that wrote it. But in all reality, they're not exactly sure. Many of the scholars and commentators, who are just not commentators, they're, see if you guys caught that one. Anyway, you know, they're not exactly sure who wrote this. It could have been a scribe of David. You know, they're not sure. But no matter how it has been attributed to Samuel because much of it, you know, was written in essence in one book, one scroll. But there's a division here because of the death of Saul, the end of one reign and the beginning of another reign. That's why they divided the books up. But tonight, it's very interesting. We're going to do a little bit of homework, a little bit of research. I'm going to show you a couple of things here and give you a little bit of opinion, a little bit of what we kind of come to, and then let you make your own decision. So it's a recap, if you will, of chapter 31 in 1 Samuel. So let's take a look. It says in verse 1, chapter 1, the book of 2 Samuel. Now it came to pass after the death of Saul, when David had returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites, and David had stayed 2 days in Ziklag. Now remember, David came back, he was getting ready to go fight with the Philistines against Saul and the Jews. God stepped in and said, okay, enough's enough, David. This little sham has gone on long enough. You get back. And so literally, God intervened and stopped this from happening. But remember, David had gotten comfortable, and we've talked about this before. We talked about this a few weeks ago, that sometimes we can get comfortable just sitting. You know, man, it's real easy. When things are going good, we don't like to move. But sometimes God is saying, I want you to move. And so sometimes that means you get fired from your job. Sometimes that means that, you know, different things may happen in our life where God says, it's time to make a move. I've been trying to give you the message. You're not listening, so I will do it for you. So David goes back to Ziklag, and there the city has been burned. Everyone's been taken captive. David then knows, okay, I got to go. And God tells him, don't worry, all the people are fine. This is just my method of telling you, you belong in Judah, not in the Philistine country. So David goes, gets all the people, they come back, and they're sitting there, and they're kind of waiting to hear exactly what happened with the battle with the Philistines. And so they're in that area. So notice, interesting. And David stayed 2 days in Ziklag. On the third day, 3 days. Does that sound familiar? It's always a picture of resurrection. Interesting. Behold, it happened that a man from Saul's camp with his clothes torn and dust on his head. And so it was when he came to David that he fell to the ground and prostrated himself. So David and his men, they come back to Ziklag and they say, hey, we're going to hang out here till we find out what happens in this battle with King Saul and the Philistines. On the third day, so it took this guy 3 days to get from the area, it's about 85 miles from where the battle would have taken place up in the Galilee area, to walk this far. So obviously this guy knew that David was to be the next king, and we're going to give you proof of that in just a minute. David just destroys the Amalekites. Keep that in your thought process. He just destroyed a bunch of them for sacking Ziklag. And so David said to him, verse 3, where have you come from? And so he said to him, I have escaped from the camp of Israel. And David said to him, how did the matter go? Please tell me. And he answered, well, the people have fled from the battle. Many of the people are fallen dead. And Saul and Jonathan, his son, are dead also. So David said to the young man who told him, how do you know that Saul and Jonathan are dead? Then the young man who told him said, as I happened by chance to be on Mount Gilboa, there was Saul leaning on his spear, and indeed the chariots and the horsemen followed hard after him. Now, when he looked behind him, he saw me, and he called to me, and I answered, here I am. And he said to me, who are you? So I answered him, I am an Amalekite. And Saul said, bummer. And he said to me again, please stand over me and kill me, for anguish has come upon me, but my life still remains in me. So I stood over him and I killed him, because I was sure that he could not live after he had fallen. And I took the crown that was on his head and the bracelet that was on his arm, and I have brought them here to my Lord. So obviously, this is more proof that this guy knew, or he had heard through the rumblings or whatever, that David was going to be the next king. And so, an interesting account of what took place with Saul. Now, let's go ahead and finish this, and then we're going to come back. Therefore, David took hold of his own clothes, and he tore them. And so did all the men who were with him. And they mourned, and they wept, and they fasted until evening for Saul and Jonathan, his son, and for the people of the Lord, and for the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword. You can imagine this Amalekite. He has come to David thinking, dude, I just did you a good favor. Look, here's the crown that was on his head, and the royal bracelet that was on his hand. I brought him to you. You're supposed to be the next king, right? I did you a favor. Saul, the guy that's been chasing you around for the last 10 years. Saul, your enemy, I finished him off for you. So he probably thought David was going to say, dude, awesome, good job. Here, let me give you a reward. And all of a sudden, David goes, no! And he tears his clothes and he sits down and he puts ashes on his head. And everybody, you know, David turns around to all of the men and he says, Saul and Jonathan are dead. You can imagine this guy going, this is not good. This could be a real problem. This isn't the reaction that I thought it was going to take. I was expecting a totally different response to this. You're not offering me any money. Instead, you're grieving. And so You see, he thought that this was going to be a good thing because his heart was corrupt. But he didn't know the heart of King David. And this just exposed two different men's hearts. And so it's an interesting thing. He didn't know what was about ready to happen. And so then, verse 13, David said to the young men who told him, "Where are you from?" Now remember, they've mourned all afternoon into the evening. The sun has set. Time for mourning is now finished. David calls him back. "So tell me where you're from again." And he answered and he said, "I am a son of an alien, an Amalekite." So David said to him, "How was it that you were not afraid to put forth your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?" And David called one of the young men and said to him, "Go near, execute him." And so he struck him so that he died. So David said to him, "Your blood is on your own head, for your own mouth has testified against you, saying, 'I have killed the Lord's anointed.'" Not quite the reception that he wanted, would we agree? Now, we've just encountered an interesting dilemma here. We have encountered something that, as we have seen how David comes back, he's patient, he's had opportunity to kill Saul. He's refused to do that. He said, when God's finished with him, God will take him out. Now then, when we looked at chapter 31, let's go back. Look what it says. In chapter 31, let's read it again. Then I'm going to take you over to 1 Chronicles, and we're going to put some pieces of a puzzle together. "Now the Philistines fought against Israel, and the men of Israel fled from before the Philistines, and they fell on Mount Gilboa." Okay, so far so good. "And the Philistines followed hard after Saul and his sons. And the Philistines killed Jonathan, Abinadab, Malchishua, Saul's sons. The battle became fierce against Saul, and the archers hit him, and he was severely wounded by the archers. Then Saul said to his armor bearer, 'Draw your sword and thrust me through with it, lest these uncircumcised men come and thrust me through and abuse me.' But his armor bearer would not, for he was greatly afraid. Therefore Saul took a sword and fell on it. And when his armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell on his sword and died with him. So Saul, his three sons, his armor bearer, and all his men died together that same day." So, a little bit different. Now, come back to 1 Samuel chapter 1 and turn to the right with me to 1 Chronicles. In chapter 10, let's read another one. And we'll put this piece together. Or I'll give you my opinion and leave it for you to come up with your own ideas. 1 Chronicles chapter 10, in verse 1. "Now, the Philistines fought against Israel, and the men of Israel fled from before the Philistines and fell slain on Mount Gilboa." So Mount Gilboa is where the battle took place. "Then the Philistines followed hard." Oh, and I was going to bring you guys pictures tonight, and I forgot. It's Josh's fault. You know what? Don't let me forget, Mari. I was going to bring them pictures of of the Mount Gilboa area. See, how can I bring you pictures if I can't even remember what it is? It's over 40 moment. No, I'll remember. Just bring pictures and I'll remember it. Okay? Yeah. Okay. So, now, hang on a minute. Let me go back. And Bethshan. I was going to show, because Mount Gilboa is right at the foot of Bethshan, and I was going to show you the pictures of where they hung Saul's body. So I was going to show you pictures of Bethshan. So, Mount Gilboa, verse 2. "Then the Philistines followed hard after Saul and his sons, and the Philistines killed Jonathan, Abinadab, Malchishua, Saul's sons. The battle became fierce against Saul. The archers hit him, and he was wounded by the archers. Then Saul said to his armor bearer, "Draw your sword and thrust me through with it, lest these uncircumcised men come and abuse me." But his armor bearer would not, for he was greatly afraid. Therefore Saul took a sword and fell on it. When his armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell on his sword and died. So Saul and his three sons died, and all the house, his house died together. When all the men of Israel who were in the valley saw that they had fled, and that Saul and his sons were dead, they forsook their cities and they fled. And the Philistines came and they dwelt in it. So it happened the next day, when the Philistines came to strip the slain, that they found Saul and his sons fallen at Mount Gilboa. They stripped him, took his head and his armor bearer, and sent word throughout the land of the Philistines to proclaim the news in the temple of their gods, or their idols, and among the people. Remember that, because that has to do with David's song that we'll get into here in just a moment. Then they put his armor in the temple of their gods and fastened his head in the temple of Dagon. And when all Jabesh-Gilead heard that the Philistines had done to Saul, all the valiant men arose, took the body of Saul and the bodies of his sons, and they brought them to Jabesh. That's on the other side. That's on the Jordanian side. In fact, I think I have pictures of Jabesh also. And they buried their bones under the tamarisk tree in Jabesh, and they fasted 7 days. Now, this is where it gets important. Verse 13. So Saul died, why? For his unfaithfulness which he had committed against the Lord. Because he did not keep the word of the Lord, number one, and also because he consulted a medium for guidance. But he did not inquire of the Lord. Therefore he, capital H, God, killed him and turned the kingdom over to David, the son of Jesse. So here we have two accounts that are almost identical, except the commentary that comes at the end, where we see that God is declaring he suffered the consequences of his choice. He was unfaithful in what he committed to do when God gave him in strict instructions. He was unfaithful to do that. Secondly, for going to the witch of Endor and, you know, having this witch call up Samuel. But here we see that who ultimately was responsible for bringing an end to Saul's life? God was. So the interesting thing is that here the commentary is that we are told that there was two primary reasons for Saul's demise. Number one, now come back to our study in 2 Samuel chapter 1. So first of all then, one of the primary things is that he was not faithful to do what he had been told to do. So, interesting. We come back to the story of this guy that is this unnamed or unknown Amalekite. I find that very interesting. Was this guy telling the truth? There are some commentators that say he was not. There are some that believe that he was a scavenger. He was an Amalekite, obviously, but that he was a scavenger. They would come in behind the Philistines after battles, and, you know, they would go in and they would just try to find anything they could scavenge. Now, what's interesting is that this dude ended up with King Saul's crown and, you know, and his gauntlet that he would wear on his arm. Now, how that guy had to have gotten in there quick to get his hands on this equipment. But it is interesting that he did have it. It is interesting that God allowed this man to bring that news to David. The news that David was waiting for. How did the battle go? What happened? It is interesting that this particular man was the one that, of all the people that could have brought this news to David, it is this guy. So, is he telling the truth? I don't really know. There are some that say, no, he wasn't telling the truth, because in two instances we have the story of David telling his armor bearer, you know what, I'm wounded, finish me off. His armor bearer said, I won't do that because you're my king. I won't do that. So then we read that Saul commits suicide. So then, this guy, it appears, could be telling a complete lie. Maybe he was in it for the money. Maybe he was in it for some sort of reward. Maybe he was in it just for position, that he thought that David would give him a position. Man, you know, you did a good thing, and so now I'm going to put you in my army or whatever. Possibly. That's one theory. The other theory is, could it be David tells his armor bearer, hey, do me in. He says, no, I won't do that. He falls, you know, he says, all right, then he puts his sword, you know, his spear down. He falls on it himself. His armor bearer does the same thing. This Amalekite comes up, sees Saul laying there. He's trying to take the stuff off of, you know, Saul's head. He's trying to scavenge. You know, Saul wakes up, and this guy says, oh, I thought you were dead. Well, you know, do me in, because I don't want these guys to come and abuse me. And the guy kills him. Possible. That's possible also. And so both of these are interesting possibilities. What is interesting is that the ultimate end is that God knew that it was time for Saul's kingdom to end and David's to begin. Could God have allowed him to die in any means? When God is the one that gives life, God's the one that takes it away. I find it interesting that no matter how we look at this scenario, was the guy a liar? Possibly. He very well could have been telling a big honking whopper. Or was the guy telling the truth? It's interesting that David kind of gives us an interesting idea that he wasn't quite sure if the guy's telling the truth or not. Because he said, by your own mouth, so whether you're telling me the truth or not, you said it. And that's enough for me to do you in. So bottom line is, what is interesting is that of all the people that God chose to bring this message to David, he chooses an Amalekite. If the man did kill him, which personally, I kind of lean towards that myself, and I'll tell you why. Turn with me now, back to the left, to 1 Samuel chapter 15. Let's find out what in the world took place of the two things we, you know, was just recently, you know, that we learned about Saul going to visit, you know, the witch of Endor. And so, let's just take a quick peek at something, and I want you to see what takes place with Saul and the first instance. Okay? So, Saul had been given instructions to utterly destroy. Look what it says in chapter 15. Samuel also said to Saul, the Lord sent me to anoint you king over his people, over Israel. Now therefore, heed the voice of the words of the Lord. Thus says the Lord of hosts, I will punish Amalek for what he did to Israel, how he ambushed him on the way when he came up from Egypt. Now, verse 3, go and attack Amalek and utterly destroy all that they have. Do not despair them. Or spare them, but kill both man and woman, infant, nursing child, ox, sheep, camel, donkey. In other words, utterly destroy these people. And we got into an in-depth study that we won't get into about the reason why on that night. That's pretty black and white instruction. Would we agree? Destroy everything. Okay, does that leave anything left to the imagination? I don't think so. Okay? So Saul gathers the people, they go into the battle. And then we come down and it says in verse 7, and so Saul attacked the Amalekites from Havilah all the way to Shur, which is east of Egypt. Verse 8, he also took Agag, king of the Amalekites, alive and utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep, the oxen, the fatlings, the lambs, and all that was good. and were unwilling to destroy them. But everything despised and worthless they utterly destroyed. And obviously he left some people alive, because David just got done attacking another group of Amalekites. So here is the instance where Saul was not obedient to do what God had asked him to do. What was the consequence? Look what it says. Now the word of the Lord came to Samuel, saying, I greatly regret that I have set Saul up as king, for he has turned back from following me and has not performed my commandments. And it grieved Saul that he cried out to the Lord all night. And so, move down to verse 22. You remember, move to 17. So Samuel said, when you were little in your own eyes, were you not head of the tribes of Israel? And did not the Lord anoint you king over Israel? Now the Lord has sent you on a mission. And he said, go utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they are consumed. Why then did you not obey the voice of the Lord? Why did you swoop down on the spoil and do evil in the sight of the Lord? And Saul said to Samuel, but I have obeyed the voice of the Lord. I have gone on the mission which the Lord sent me. And I brought back King Agag of Amalek. We're going to talk a little bit about this on Sunday. I have utterly destroyed the Amalekites, but the people took of the plunder, the sheep and the oxen and the best of the fatlings, which should have been utterly destroyed, but they did it to sacrifice to the Lord your God in Gilgal. And Samuel said, and we're going to talk about this Sunday, has the Lord as great a delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams. Interesting, for rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft. Isn't that interesting? When we talked about that last time, his rebellion led him to a witch in the end. Isn't that ironic? And so he says, because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has rejected you from being king. Now then, we come back to that is the reason that God says, I'm going to deal with this. So let me give you a little bit of why I believe that this Amalekite is telling the truth. My opinion, okay? Let me make that clear to you. It's interesting that the Amalekites are a picture or a type of the flesh, a type of sin, if you will. Because here we saw that Samuel referred to them as God told you to destroy those sinners. They were corrupt to the core. God, having foreknowledge, he knew that none of them were ever going to turn out. So he said, destroy that. Get rid of it. And so now we see Saul was unwilling to do that. He was unwilling to deal with these people that represent the flesh. So in all reality, it is a picture of if a person is unwilling to deal with sin in our life, if we're unwilling to deal with the flesh, guess what happens? It always comes back to bite you. Always. We're reading, if you're doing the one-year study with us, did you catch this morning as Noah, the only one that God allows, him and his family, to go from the old world that God destroyed, he brings them into the new world. But he brought something with him. He brought his sinful heart. And did you see? He also brought the knowledge of how to make alcohol. So he comes into the new, still knows how to do that. He makes alcohol, he gets drunk, and you read the story where Ham comes walking in, does an unkosher thing, and sees his dad naked, and all of that, then it begins the whole sinful process again. You just wonder, how much can God put up with? You know, why does he put up with us? Mari was saying that, why does God put up with us? You know. But so here we see then that if we are unwilling to deal with the flesh, when God tells us, I want you to deal with this, there's a sin in your life, I want it dealt with, and we are unwilling to deal with it, if we begin to compromise with it, if we begin to justify it, if we begin to defend it, as Saul did, that we just read in chapter 15, look what comes around to get him in the end. And so he tries to, you know, to kill himself, but then that fleshly thing, this is why my opinion is that I wouldn't be surprised if he finished him off. Because, man, I have seen any time that God tells me, Rob, this is something I want you to deal with, and I postpone, and I justify, and I defend, it always comes back to bite me. And so here we see an interesting picture of exactly what, you know, this Amalekite represents. Hold your spot here and turn with me over to Galatians chapter 5 in the New Testament, all the way over to Galatians. In Galatians chapter 5, let me just show you something. In Galatians 5, in 24, verse 24, and those who are Christ's have, past tense, crucified the flesh with its passions and desires. If we live in the Spirit, let us also walk in the Spirit. Let us not become conceited, provoking one another and envying one another. And so, look what it says in verse 16, same chapter. I say then, walk in the Spirit, and you shall not fulfill the lust of the flesh. So, what is the remedy, the only remedy for the flesh? Kill it. Crucify it, Paul says. Put it to death. Reckon it to be dead. Acknowledge that it is dead in all reality. So when the flesh rears itself, if we compromise, if we justify, if we defend, if we make excuses, is that killing it? No. That means we're toying with it. If we say, well, but I can fix my flesh. See, that's what Saul kind of said. I can fix this. You know, if I follow 12 steps, it can be fixed. No, there is no remedy for the flesh other than death. Then we can walk in the Spirit, you see? And so, interesting in this particular passage that we have this picture of God saying, Saul, I want you to utterly destroy it. Kill it. Saul doesn't do that. And in the end, it comes back to bite him. And so, whether or not the guy really did it, he said it. It is interesting that it is an Amalekite at the end of the story who had to be in it. You know, obviously, he didn't hear about what David just did to a bunch of Amalekites, or he wouldn't have come over bragging, I'm an Amalekite. Somebody would say, dude, not a good idea. Don't say that. We just killed about 150, you know. So, to me, I wonder if, you know, we'll find out when we get there. But when God does things and he works in these kind of pictures, why did he allow this guy to come and tell him? And so then what does David do? Kill it. Put it to death. David knew what Saul obviously was commanded to do, and David is the one that is exercising God's judgment upon the Amalekites. Kill this guy. Put this thing to death. We're not going to let this come back and bite me again. And so for each of us, man, oh man, let this be a lesson for all of us that, you know, if we have a temper problem, if we have, you know, a problem of what we are battling with our flesh, if it's a lust issue, if it's, you know, whatever it is that God is trying to show you, and you're saying, well, but Rob, because I have people tell me this all the time, but Rob, you make that sound so easy. You make it sound simple. Well, death, dying to ourself, putting the flesh to death, is not an easy thing. It's a slow, agonizing process. You know, my flesh gasps for breath. It will lie there and try to figure out ways to keep and to, okay, but wait a minute. All right, but Lord, what if I do this? But Lord, you know, honestly, I could use this for ministry. That's what Saul said, didn't he? Well, but we kept this good stuff. See, in all reality, we're going to use this. We're going to sacrifice it to the Lord. Lord, honest. If you give me, you know, Crystal's Camaro, I will use it for ministry. She has my car, you know. And honest, Lord, I'll put Calvary Chapel on the side. I'll pick the old ladies up on the way in. But the Lord knows he can't give that to me. He knows that's that would be a part of my flesh. Because Crystal would have given it to me by now, I'm sure. And so I'm telling you, you know, for me, and maybe you're relating to what I'm saying, because if you've seen it in your life, as you've walked with the Lord and you see our battle with our flesh, there's only one provision. You cannot, you know, you can take a pig and you can clean it up, you can dress it up and put perfume on it and all that, but it's still a pig. And it will always go back to the mud. It's just a pig. And we talked about that, you know, the only remedy for our flesh, the only remedy for sin, kill it. Reckon it to be dead. Reckon it to be what God has already says. Rob, kill it. Don't try to mess with it. Turn from it. Turn towards me. Do what I tell you to do, and I will give you the power and the ability to do what I've asked you to do. And therein is the victory. And if we don't, it will come back and get you. You know, it's a funny thing, you know, that, you know, well, point made. I think you get the picture. Do you get the picture with me? Are you following it? Okay, very good. So, interesting, you know, David, I find it fascinating that we see more of a picture of this beautiful, beautiful heart that David has, that even on at this particular point in time, David never considered Saul as his enemy, ever. Even though he's been running from him, Saul's been trying to kill him, he refuses to call him his enemy. Never once did David disrespect this man. And so it's interesting that God has a plan, but he also has a goal. He also has a destination for David. But yet, it's the fascinating part about this is that what we have to understand is that we are such goal-oriented people. We see the goal, and that's what we say. I got to get there. And God is the type that says, don't you worry about there, because I care more about the process. I'll get you to the goal. But the process is, I believe, more important or as important to God as the goal is. You see? Because he wants to get us from point A to point B. We're going to get there. He's done that with David. Here he is as a young man. He anoints him to be the next king of Israel. He grows up in the house of Saul. He learns how to do things the wrong way. Then, as he becomes a man, and everything he touches turns to gold, Saul becomes jealous, starts chasing him down. David has been in this process that has revealed his heart. So now he's now the king. But God has cared about the process that he's had him in this whole time. So never despise the process. That is a part of, you know, what we would, you know, classify it, you know, because someday we're going to heaven and we're going to get there. But this journey that we're on is equally as important to God, if not more important. And so never forget that, you know, that God has tested David's heart for years. He continues to test ours. And that is, you know, a part of the process that we are involved in. I think that, you know, people, we can be so impatient, so goal-oriented. And I'm learning to see God in the process, in the daily part of the process. And so that we learn to trust him no matter what. I mean, can you imagine David going, Lord, how much longer is it? You anointed me to be the king. What's up with this? When is it going to happen? When do I get to be the guy in charge here? Saul continuing to mess up. Never did those words come out of his mouth. Came out of his man's mouth. So what does come out of a man's mouth at a time like this? Let's take a look. Verse 17. Then David lamented with this lamentation over Saul and over Jonathan, his son. And he told them, all of his people, to teach the children of Judah the song of the bow. Indeed, it is written in the book of Jasher, a book that we don't have. And so now I want you to listen carefully to how David speaks of this man who has hunted him down for 10 years, who has taken the position of the first king of Israel, trashed it, trashed the people. The guy is schizo. He's lived a completely bad example. But watch the way David refers to him. The beauty of Israel is slain on your high places. How the mighty have fallen. He refers to the beauty of Israel as David, as Saul and Jonathan. He doesn't say, the scum of Israel is finally gone. That would have been Rob's writing. But what do you see David say? Oh, the beauty of Israel. The first king. Jonathan, my friend. Tell it not in Gath. Proclaim it not in the streets of Ashkelon. Interesting, Gath is the capital of the Philistines city. Ashkelon is the religious capital. So that's why I told you to remember what I said earlier. Because now he says, don't go let the Philistines know, because, man, if it gets to the capital, they're going to be bragging about how they've killed the leader of Israel. And if it gets to Ashkelon, they're going to give all the credit to their gods and their idols. Well, it already happened. David just didn't know. Proclaim it not, he says, lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised triumph. Let's not give, in other words, the enemy a reason to rejoice or give them any credit whatsoever. Fascinating. This is how David begins, and he says, I want everyone to remember this. Teach this song to your kids. I don't want anyone to forget this song. O mountains of Gilboa, let there be no dew or rain upon you, nor fields of offering, for the shield of the mighty is cast away there. The shield of Saul, not anointed with oil. In other words, it's kind of a picture that where he died, you know, we see this all around our crazy city, don't we? That we see these little memorials put up all around our dangerous little town. And so this was kind of David's, you know, suggestion. Let that whole valley be a place of memorial. Let nothing grow there. In other words, let's let even the creation mourn for the great King Saul. This is how David is speaking of a man that hunted him down, treated him like trash, with disrespect, trashed the whole, you know, being the first king. He was a lousy king for all intents and purposes. And yet, look at how David speaks of him. And then he talks about, you know, the shield of Saul. Oftentimes, before they would go into battle, they would be anointed by the priest. Well, he didn't have that. So basically, David is saying God removed his protection from King Saul. And now, even Israel, because he was the shield of Israel, because he was the king. And understand now, in all reality, he had fought and won many battles. So not only is he saying God removed his protection, but now in a different sense, the protection of Israel, the king of Israel, has been removed also. And so he says, from the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan did not turn back, and the sword of Saul did not return empty. In other words, they got some of their guys also, but they're not coming home this time. And Saul and Jonathan, he says in verse 23, were beloved and pleasant in their lives. Are you guys hearing the way that David is speaking of these guys? I understand, with Jonathan I could understand it. But I tell you, David is a way better man than I am. And in their death they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles and they were stronger than lions. O daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you in scarlet with luxury, who put ornaments of gold on your apparel. See, even though in many ways, you got to understand, we have to go back to what transitioned here. We went from the time of the judges, remember, to Samuel, who was the link between the judges and the first king. When we were in the judges, remember how it ended? Every man did what was right in his own eyes. They were a divided people. Now, at least under Saul, he was able to, all of Israel said, we now have one king. And he was able to gather the people back together. They were kind of united under Saul, even though he was, you know, a spaz. He gathered the people together. So as a nation, they had won battles and victories, so they were bringing the loot of some of these areas. So financially, they were doing better because they weren't just thinking about themselves anymore. And so what does David do? Instead of focusing on all the stuff that he didn't do and the stuff that he did wrong, he focuses on what Saul did that was good. You getting this? And so he goes on to say, how the mighty have fallen. Again, that's the second time. In the midst of the battle, Jonathan was slain in your high places. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. You have been very pleasant to me. Your love to me was wonderful, surpassing the love of women. How the mighty have fallen and the weapons of war perished. Now, before we kind of wrap this up and give you a couple ideas, interesting little passage right there. That those that are involved in the homosexual lifestyle that have any kind of biblical understanding, they will point to this and say, you see, David and Jonathan were homosexuals. Based upon that little passage right there. That they had a love for each other that was more than either one of them had with a woman. That is not at all what that says at all. This is Hebrew poetry. And David was a poet. He was a songwriter. What he is saying here, because David had two wives. David, you know, has a problem with women, as we're going to find out here later on. Okay? So that is not at all what this is, what it is saying. He is talking about this deep friendship that these guys were blood brothers. You remember that? These two guys were the best of friends. Something that is very, very rare for most men. Because I look back on my life, and I mean, I've had best friends in my life. But, you know, Mari and I, we were up at the Murrieta at the Bible College yesterday. They're having the missions conference this week. And so while we were there, our daughter, Christy's up there and Cassie's up there, and we sent those two girls up there for the missions conference. And so we wanted to take them because, you know, Cassie has this love for Africa, and so does, and Christy does too. And so we took them over to far-reaching ministries. We want to introduce some of the people, and they're very involved down in Africa. And so before we left, I told Christy, I said, well, let's take you. Oh, and Christian, our pastor from Heidelberg, is up there also. And so Christy came out with a bunch of the gang from Herborn, Germany, and where Marcus, her, well, guy, is from. And you know, she's got these group of kids, and she's got the youth pastor from Herborn. So we take nine of us and all of these kids from Germany. And I said, come on, you guys, we're going to take you to lunch. We're going to take you to the epitome of American gluttony. And we took them to the hometown buffet. It was so funny because I took the youth pastor and another kid, who were pretty good-sized kids, and I took them up to the dessert bar area, and I said, you see all this? Yeah. As much as you want. Eat it. You can come back as many times as you want. They go, as many times as we want? Yeah. This is America. And I said, that's how you get one of these. But anyway, as it turned out, this youth pastor has known Marcus since they were 3 years old. Buddies, since they were three. Now, with women, that's not as uncommon. I mean, you do find many women that still have friends that they've had friends since they were little kids. But for men, this is very rare. You know, I mean, I'm not saying it's impossible, but it is rare. David and Jonathan had formed a bond. They had formed a friendship. They were brother-in-law now because David married, you remember, Michal. And so what this is a reference to is, man, we had a love for each other that was stronger than what we will ever have with our wives. We shared everything together. We were blood brothers. We were soul brothers, you see. It has nothing to do with homosexuality. So If you ever get into that kind of a conversation with someone that wants to use that, you now know how to answer that. But I think a fascinating picture here is David did a couple things with this song. First of all, he showed his grief. He sat down and in his grief, he writes this beautiful song. And the amazing thing is that I believe that David also made sure to show respect, that everyone, he was leading by an example to say, I respect King Saul, and I'm going to write a song that shows the respect for King Saul, and I want all of Israel to respect him. That's one thing that he did. Well, another thing. I think it's fascinating also, because remember, Israel has just moved into a monarchy where they have a king. And as Saul totally turned that into a mess, I believe that David also is pointing to this, saying, we're going to honor the monarchy because I'm the next guy that's coming in line here. And I'm going to show you that we are honoring the monarchy. And I am honoring that. And I see what God has done. And God has been the one that has done this. God has established it. And when I take over, we're going to continue to honor that by writing this beautiful song. But also, we see that David showed that he did not hold any kind of a grudge against Saul. Even though all the rest of the people, even David's own men, said, David, this is your opportunity. You can kill him. David said, no, I do not consider him my enemy. And he set and he showed an example to the people of what it's like to say, I trust that God is in ultimate control, that even though Saul was trying to kill me, I hold nothing against this man. He respected the position and he respected the man, even though the man did not deserve it. Isn't that interesting? That stings a little bit, doesn't it? Because, you know, there are going to be people that, you know, I think that the final thing really, you know, with all of those pieces put together, that it's an example to you and to me to respect the leaders that God has placed over us, whether we like them or agree with them or not, whether it be at the place that we work or where we, you know, buy our gas or, you know, whatever it may be, you know, we need to respect the people that we come in contact with, the leaders that God places over us, even Nancy Pelosi. And I'm not supposed to be political. But, you know, I look at these things, you know, we are to respect the leadership because why? If you understand that God is ultimately in control, then you understand that God is the one that places those that are in leadership over us, whether we agree with them or not, whether we like their decisions or not. That's the God's in control, so God is the one that I have. You know, so it's a way in all reality of showing our love and our respect to the Lord by loving and respecting those that he's placed over us. Fascinating picture. Very convicting in some ways. You know, I was on the phone with Kaiser the other day and trying to get this little gal to just answer a couple of questions for me. And she was saying, sir, I am not allowed to give you that information. And I said, well, but you need to understand, I'm the guy that's going to pay this bill. Sir, as I already explained to you, I'm not going to give you that information. And let me tell you, that flesh, I had to kill it right there because I wanted to be disrespectful right back. And yet, you know, when you understand, okay, Lord, what are you up to here? You're in control. You put me on the phone with this little punk kid. So, who is it that you're dealing with? Might even be your own husband or your wife or your dad or your mom. They're the ones God's given to you. We respect them. We show that respect. The position deserves it. But David even went farther. He didn't just say, okay, I'll respect the position. He even showed respect to a man that deserved and earned no respect. That's radical to me. It's a beautiful picture. That's why he's a picture of Jesus Christ in the Old Testament. We'll get more into that next week. So let's pray, shall we? Lord, thank you so much for this amazing text, this picture of our flesh, the Amalekites, that sin in our life, that ugliness, Lord. If we're battling a sin tonight, if there's something in our flesh that we're wrestling with, may we stop wrestling and reckon it to be dead before it comes back to kill us. And so tonight, Lord, maybe it might be also an area where you've put someone over us, someone in our circle that hasn't earned respect, doesn't deserve it. Maybe that's the piece of the flesh that we're battling with tonight. Lord, what beautiful lessons. May we learn to trust you. May we learn to wait upon your timing. May we learn, Lord, that you are in control, and to allow you, Lord, to do that work in our life, to be patient, to follow you no matter what. Lord, I thank you that David is that beautiful example of who Jesus really is, the fulfillment. So we give you our hearts tonight, Lord. May you deal with our hearts. May you continue, Lord, to expose my heart, expose our hearts as we seek to serve you. In Jesus' name, amen. Let's all stand, shall we? May the Lord richly bless you as you take these things to heart, consider them, ponder on them, and then allow him to bring it to life in your life as you walk with him. God bless you guys. May you discover more of his love than you knew before you came in here tonight. We'll see you on Sunday.
Your love is amazing, steady and unchanging. Your love is a mountain.